Welcome back to all of you faithful patrons of the Shea Bippy Bar. Welcome to your first edition in 2020 of the Shea Bippy Mob Pod, a podcast you can't refuse. I am Mike DeBate, your co-host of Shea Bippy, and of course, joining me as always, he is the owner, the proprietor of Shea Bippy. He is the Sonny to my Jimmy Whispers. My good friend Thomas Murphy once again joins me on the other side of the microphone. Worf, welcome back to the bar.
Oh, dude, it's been too long. It's been too long since we sat down and frickin' had a drink and just talked some good movies. And we got a good one today, don't we?
We absolutely do. One of the finest, one of the most misunderstood in the genre. And I'm going to explain a little bit what I mean by that. But obviously, we are talking about the 1974 classic by Sergio Leone entitled Once Upon a Time in America. And obviously, launch really, I don't want to say it was the launch or the springboard of a lot of different careers, but you take a look back and it really was the crown jewel, the early crown jewel of actors such as Robert De Niro, James Woods, Joe Pesci, Danny Aiello, Elizabeth McGovern, just to name a few. I think this is really a very seminal movie when it comes to the genre, and one that I think has only grown in its, I guess the best way for me to put it is I think it's grown in its reputation over the years, because ironically, Murph, this wasn't one that was well received by the critics when it first came out.
No, it really wasn't. And you can only blame the studio for that. When I hated this movie the first time I saw it, I was really looking forward to it. And I went there and I hated it. Couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did was they took a director's magnum opus and turned it into a short film. The movie is set during Prohibition, and right. It centers around four young friends who are, you know, just happen to be thugs and hooligans from a small Jewish neighborhood in New York. And it was supposed to be something that audiences in America didn't get to see. It was at the time, it was supposed, the runtime I think was 3 hours and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And the studios didn't think that Americans could sit through a movie that long, and so they cut it down by well over an hour, didn't they?
Yeah, they actually cut it down to about a two-hour runtime when this originally came out. And
yeah.
Treat Williams is one of the actors that I didn't mention early on in terms of springboarding. You want to talk about springboarding of careers. Treat obviously was in this movie. And when he found out that the original, it was actually 3 hours and 49 minutes was the original cut. They cut it down to a two-hour version. And Treat was very vocal at the time and said, no one's going to understand the point of this movie when you cut it down so much. It doesn't give you the opportunity to understand it in the shortened version. And as a result, the film didn't do well at theaters. We talked about that. It was shut out of the Oscars. It received no nominations, which I think is a real travesty. When you take a look at the individual performances in this movie, really, I think you're surprised when you see it. And that was one of the things that stood out to me when I went back and I rewatched this movie is, how could nobody in this movie have been nominated for an Oscar? And then you think about what the studio did to it, and it makes perfect sense. But when the video cassette and the DVD versions were released, and the original 3-hour and 49-minute version, which I assume in preparations is the version that you watched coming into to talk about this today, that was the version that ultimately found the commercial success, the critical success, and really what the movie was intended to be. So I think in a lot of ways, this was a tale of two movies, and that's why I alluded to this being the most misunderstood of the genre, because it started out as being a movie that
it
was
actually
so critically
killed
panned.
It really killed it for a long time. You didn't see another good mob movie until Goodfellas.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It was awful what they did to the entire genre. This movie was supposed to be set through a scene of flashbacks and drug induced delusions. And you didn't get that in the American release. It opened up completely differently. We got it was set chronologically, And it was terrible. Even though I love every child actor in this film, the kids who played the parts of Noodles and Max and Deborah
right.
were all fantastic. You know, Cockeye, all those they were fantastic young actors. And nobody ever got to really appreciate that until later on when we all sat down with that big two, they called it a box set back then, the two-part cassette, you know, that you had to get up and go put in into the VCR and change it over. And we didn't appreciate it, and I didn't get to appreciate it until that very point. But no, like you said, it really launched a lot of people's careers. This was the first movie I remember seeing Joe Pesci in. And I'm not sure if it was his first or not. Mike would probably know better than that, because he's the brains here. I'm just, you know, the eye candy, you know, kind of like Jennifer Connelly, Tuesday Weld. But yeah, no. This movie was never fully appreciated until you got to see it the way the rest of the world did. And I'm ashamed to say that I don't know if it got any awards anywhere, but it was completely shut out here in the United States simply because the studio was stupid.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, not knowing how to market and not knowing how to maximize the return on a movie like this really hurt Once Upon a Time in America, and it hurt it for a good long time. And you were absolutely right when you said that, Murph. It almost killed the picture. You know, it really did. Thankfully, you know, with the release of videotape and the release of DVDs, and, you know, the kids today will never understand. Murph and I go back long enough to remember that double box set that he was talking about, the two cassettes. And that up here, you know, we're both, you know, natives of the Northeast. That was what was called a snowy day movie.
Absolutely. Yeah, still have my Godfathers, still had this. And,
absolutely.
You know, because I can't throw them away.
It's true. I can't either. I still have the Godfather Part 3 that had the two gold color tapes, and I remember that. I thought that was so cool when I was a kid seeing that, and the tapes were in that gold plastic color. And it's almost like, you know, wow, this is so far above, you know. But we grew up in the Northeast. This was what was called one of those snowy afternoon type movies where you threw it in and it occupied you for at least 2, 3, 4 hours, however long you wanted to watch. And again, for those of you that don't know, well, you know, obviously we'll get into the nuts and bolts of the movie. Just a little background. The film is largely based on Harry Gray, who was a gangster. That's a semi-autobiographic novel called The Hoods. But it does draw some inspiration from two other literary sources as well, and that's Jack London's novel Martin Eden. That's about a man who becomes disillusioned in his own world. That book actually does appear in the film, so if you recognize that title or you recognize seeing that, it is in the film. And also loosely based on F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel The Great Gatsby, and that really is about a man of wealth and power and who really aspires to that wealth and power to try to convince himself that he's worthy of the woman that he loves. And it's a very good parallel, I think, in a lot of ways to this. I think there are a lot of Gatsbyan type of alliterations that you see throughout the film as well. You know, I'm all about tidbits, and I'm going to give you a tidbit. I'm going to give you a first little tidbit on this, which I thought was really, really interesting. The role of Max, obviously the adult role of Max, is played by James Woods, who also happens to hail from the same state that I do in Rhode Island. James is very much the toast of the town in Warwick, Rhode Island, and he's still very much beloved. Great actor. And he was not the original choice for Max in this film. When I tell you who was, you're probably going to raise an eyebrow, figuratively and literally, probably in his honor. But you're also going to sit there and say, you know what, I can see it, but there's some aspects of it where you're just looking and saying, you know what, I think it ended up being the right move. And it was actually offered to John Belushi, believe it or not. It was written with him in mind. It was written with him as the catalyst for this. And unfortunately, he passed away before auditions began on this film. So it was, I think, a different, you know, would have been a very different role for him. It would have been a very different type movie for John Belushi. And by all accounts, toward the end of his, brief life, he was trying to broaden his horizons as
right.
an actor. He didn't want to just be pigeonholed into, you know, the drunken, you know, Bluto type characters that he had played mm-hmm. in Animal House or the Blues Brothers. He wanted to branch out from what he had done with Saturday Night Live.
Yep.
And
he had just
this could
done,
have been...
He had just done Continental Divide.
Absolutely.
And that great movie, if any of you, yep. you know, just to jump off the genre for a second. No, great movie. Go check that one out. But no, that,
yeah.
that's amazing. And yeah, yeah, I could definitely see him being Max, being that insane individual. And I told Mike something off air that we were going to jump into today that was going to be a good topic. That, you know, I had a real issue watching this movie again. Now, I'm going to preface this by stating that I have been a Republican my entire life. My entire life. My father was actually a Secret Service agent who guarded Nixon. And it was, you know, so believe me, I mean, when my father passed away, Richard Nixon wrote a letter to my mother, you know, praising. I could not get past and I'm sorry, folks, if I'm going to lose followers or listeners over this. I hate James Woods. I can't stand James Woods. I can't. He actually has me blocked on Twitter because of something that I said to him once. And I had a really difficult time enjoying this movie this time around, watching it. I had not watched this film in a very long time. And do you ever do that? Is there ever an actor that you just do not like and it completely changes your opinion of a film?
Oh, I think it's human nature. I think there's absolutely cases like that. I don't recall having a dislike for an actor early on and watching the movie and having mm-hmm. that change your opinion, but I will say this. I mean, there were times where in the aftermath of learning what we've learned about somebody like Bill Cosby and watching mm-hmm. just a rerun of the Cosby Show,
right.
now, I can't watch the show any longer.
No.
It just,
no.
it really, it bothers me. And this
yeah,
is a show that I grew up loving. I mean, he was America's dad. You watch
yep.
him talk to Theo and you're sitting there and you're like, oh, this is great. I love watching this. I can't do it
yeah.
anymore. There are some...
His films too. I'll never
exactly.
watch. I'll never watch one of his. And I loved his movies growing up. Some of the best black exploitation flicks that ever came around were with
yeah.
him and Sidney Poitier. And no, I can't watch them either. It sucks. It sucks.
Absolutely, it does. It really, really does. In a lot of respects, I always thought the highest of Kevin Spacey when it came to his acting ability. And I thought
mm-hmm.
he was brilliant in so many films. His versatility, his ability to play a character that was despicable, or his ability to play a character that you really liked. I have trouble seeing him in a different light now in terms of what
yeah.
we've heard about him and the Me Too movement and some of the difficult
yep.
you know, things that we've heard about his behavior and how he's treated people and things of that nature. Even when you think about just movies that have been produced by Harvey Weinstein and seeing the actors and
yep.
whatnot that are portraying this, I have a difficult time with those too. So no, I don't think you're way off.
And
on
the other I have not watched Captain Marvel.
Yeah,
I have not watched me. I have not watched a superhero movie simply because of the narrative from its star and the way she said, this movie isn't made for you. You're a 40-year-old man. And blah, blah, blah. Well, okay, then you won't get my money. And
yeah.
but but no,
absolutely.
Here we go. We're off the rails. And Dave Brown isn't even here, and we're off the rails. What the fuck?
No, you know what? I think I think Dave would join us in this, and I think he'd revel in some of the gifts, because I think in ways of enjoying a movie, a lot of times it's not just about taking you through the step-by-step process, because if you're tuning into Shea Bippy like you usually do, chances are, and I'm sure that there are, you know, people that have tuned in thinking about seeing this and saying, okay, well, should I see this movie? Well, let me check out and see what Mike and Murph have to offer, and that'll make my decision. But if you're tuning into Shea Bippy, it's most likely that you've seen the movie that we're chronicling, because
mm-hmm.
it gives a reaction, or you've seen it and you want to hear our thoughts, and you want to see if we share some of the same experiences that you have as well. I think
we've only done
like
one flick that's
so...
live in theaters.
Absolutely.
Or that's streaming.
Our most recent. Yeah, that's our most recent, which thank you so much for our to our listeners, by the way. I've gotten some great pieces of feedback on that show. We enjoyed doing that with Steve. Murph and I are going to open up the bar to a few more guests here in 2020 and start to you know, be a little bit more open to the bar. Not that open. That's a very select guest here at the Shea Bippy.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, we have...
It's a private club. It's a club.
It is. It's a private club.
And we invite
absolutely.
You all in, but, you know.
That's right. Absolutely. We invite all of our listeners in, but very few get a chance to actually share the stools here at the Bippy Bar. But
Capo's
in
only.
Any case, Capo's only. Absolutely. You got that. I have that badge of honor, actually, in my Twitter bio that I'm a Capo regime for the Shea Bippy Mob Bar. So,
you
know,
that,
I consider that a very, very high honor, my friend.
Consulieri's wait out front.
That's right. The consulieri, they wait out front. You have to. That's right. Now you have
you
to keep
waiting
that.
In a lobby.
You do. I go, he's got me waiting in a lobby. Oh, man. And we will be doing that one, folks. You have no worries on that.
Soon.
Godfather Part 2 will be done. It will be tackled here on Shea Bippy in 2020. But anyway, getting back to our original point, I think discussions like this are good. I think they give you a different perspective, and it lets people see maybe in a different way how we see movies. But to answer your question, your original question, no, I don't think that's that odd at all. That's happened to me several times. I'm sure it's happened to all of our listeners, where you are clouded by a director's point of view. You're clouded by your opinion of a certain actor. That's why in so many cases I recommend, if it's a great movie based on a novel or based on a book, if you have the time, I always recommend checking that out, because it gives you the opportunity to experience these types of adventures, these types of stories for yourself. And then you can see if your personality, if your personal view coincides with what the director or the actor were trying to do in that case. There's a lot of cases where mine has matched it, and there's a lot of cases where I think it's been a lot different. So, no, good piece of tidbit. You know, again, I don't know if that necessarily endears you to the Rhode Island crowd, but I can definitely see it when it comes to your opinion on James Woods. And you know what? Everybody's opinion is everybody's opinion. So
yeah, I'll be checking over my shoulder next time I'm at the zoo. That's for sure. You know.
Well, you know what? You do have some people that are like-minded here in Rhode Island as well. I guarantee you. He's a polarizing figure, James Woods, so I can definitely see where
I'm sorry, folks.
There.
I just, you know, I had to bring it up. I had to bring it up. The fact that, you know, there are reasons where you may not enjoy a movie. And this is a movie that I grew up loving. I was in my late teens when I saw it on cassette for the first time, when I saw it in the way that it was supposed to be and not the chronological order that they screwed this up with. And that's really what happened with the American release. They did it completely chronologically. You had no idea what was going on. You had no idea who some of the characters were. So make sure when you do see this movie that it is, the original, not the original American release, but the original European release, the long version. You want the long version. And right now, folks, you can actually see this movie on TCM on demand for free.
On demand.
And,
absolutely.
Yep, on demand for free.
Which is where
we both
checked it out.
And it's you know, no commercial cuts in it whatsoever. And it was you know, just getting past, you know, what we were just talking about. It is a fantastic film, and it has to be, in my estimation, one of the most graphically violent movies ever. Usually, when you see a gangster film, there are redeeming qualities in everyone, and in this film, there really isn't much of that. De Niro as Noodles has some redeeming qualities, but even when you're introduced to him, you know, he's somebody that doesn't know how to interact with people. The first time you see him, he's peeping on Jennifer Connelly, who plays Deborah in the movie, as she's practicing dancing, and
he's watching her through a peephole because he just doesn't know how to interact with her. James Woods is basically the same way. These are young kids that were immigrants to America and only knew one way to get ahead. And there was absolutely, well, yeah, I mean, Fat Mo, you could find, you like Fat Mo, but other than that, you know, when you got past these cute little kids, what's the word I'm looking for, Michael? They were delinquents from the get-go. And that's all they were through their entire lives. There was no, usually in a film like this, there's an arc and some kind of redemption, something that you want to see, a reason that you like somebody. There's a reason you liked Henry Hill. There was I didn't stop liking Henry Hill till the end of the movie when he ratted on everybody. But in this film, you really, there's nothing to grasp a hold of to say that, yes, I like these people. A lot of the time, so like you say, with The Godfather, with Pacino and The Godfather, by the time the second and third movies roll around, Michael is trying to legitimize the family. He's trying to move away from the streets. These guys never wanted to move away from the streets, ever.
Right. Absolutely. That's so well said. And I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that is, I think, one of the key messages in a movie like this. And if you haven't seen it, you have to know that going in. There aren't a lot of redeemable qualities in these characters. Mm-hmm. These guys are bad guys. They're just, it's the way it is. It's the story that's told. It's one of the first in this genre that I think really captured, and we've talked about this several times, even when we talked about movies like Eastern Promises, and we talked about, mm-hmm. you know, movies like that, where it was just, I think it was a lot of it just, it was the way that things were. And they realized in that world that nothing was going to change, where The Godfather, and even to a little bit of, you know, aspects of, you know, Goodfellas or Casino or things like that, there's a little bit of romanticizing when it comes to the type of lifestyle that they
right.
lead and the type of, you know, redeemable qualities. And Casino is a movie we haven't done here yet on Shea 50. We will. But Sam Rothstein, you know, always had that aspiration to be something.
He wanted
more
to go to Vegas
than
to
what
be legitimate.
Was.
You know,
exactly.
He wanted
These
to
guys,
be the guy at the country club. These guys
absolutely.
Never wanted to be at the country club. These guys wanted to be in the streets. They wanted to be dirty.
Right.
One of the things that even with the runtime of this movie was the fact that Robert De Niro, who plays Noodles in the David in this movie, he goes to prison. He goes to prison for killing another street thug by the name of Bugsy. After Bugsy had shot down his young friend, Noodles, I slipped, and and it was when he came out, James Woods was there waiting for him, and it has to be 20 years later. His friend Max is waiting for him, and you don't see how they became who they were, because they had already been successful. They were a successful gang that started out as young street urchins and now owned a speakeasy, and you know they were still criminals. There was still always another heist to pull off. There was still always something else to do on the criminal side. And you didn't see how they got there. And two, it reinforced the fact that these guys are criminals. They're lifelong criminals. And Noodles knew the second that he walked into that speakeasy that his life was going to be exactly the same.
Without question. And that actually leads me into a question that I wanted to ask you, because a lot of what we do when we watch these films is try to get a feel for the plot, and we try to get a feel mm-hmm. for advancing the plot. But one thing that I noticed that I thought Leone did so well was characterizing these guys, putting them into that world, and essentially allowing that world to kind of take on a life of its own. when you watch this film, or when you watch it, I should say, for the second time, because this was a movie that in its entirety, this is only the second time I've seen this all the way through from start to finish. I've been able to, watch things, back and forth, but I did watch it in one seating quite a while back, and then again, an uninterrupted seating in anticipation of today. When you look at the intercut that Leon brought, a lot of people compare it to The Godfather, and I think that, well, the part two, I should say. And I think that's a little bit unfair, because I think some people try to say that, oh, Leon tried to steal from what The Godfather Part Two did and whatnot, and I don't see that at all. I think this was absolutely key to this movie. But do you think the intercut added another dimension to these characters in terms of the... And we've talked about the evilness of these characters and how there's really not a whole lot of redeeming qualities. Do you think that took it up a level, or do you think that the intercut that Leon kind of put forth in this film did maybe less to advance some of the more minor characters that we didn't get a chance to see fleshed out, notably the character of Frankie, who's played by Joe Pesci? We talked a little bit offline about this being Pesci's first film. It actually was not his first film, but it was his first major role alongside of a guy like De Niro. So to me, I think originally in the script, the Frankie character, which is one of the reasons why Pesci had chosen this character, was because he thought it was going to be longer. In the original script, there was a lot more to this character, and we didn't end up seeing nearly half of what his character was supposed to be. Do you think that intercut maybe cut away a little bit from some of the character development we could have seen in some of the minor characters?
Possibly, but it also, I think what Leone wanted to do was what we were just talking about, how you didn't see many redeeming factors in any of these people. There was nothing really likable about them as adults. But when you intercut with the stuff that was going on with them as children, and you saw what was going on, and some of the reasons that they made the decisions that they made, the reasons that Noodles was in prison, the fact that, it was all about the four of them, five of them. And, I think it was needed. And I think it showed in the American cut, where everything was chronological, why it failed.
Right. Absolutely.
Because you didn't get to go back and see, another flashback or another, drug-induced delusion. And you needed it. It had to be there. No, I don't look at it as a ripoff at all.
Good. And I'm glad that you said that, because I didn't either. And anyone that knows me, that's followed me or listened to any, shows that I've done here on Shea Bippy or anywhere else, knows the affinity I hold for the Godfather trilogy,
right,
especially the first two movies. And in the second, I've seen both sides of it. I've seen where they have the Godfather saga, where they do show the chronological version. And it's a fun watch. It's nice because it gives you the story from start to finish. But to me, I don't think it's ever approached what the original cut of The Godfather Part Two does with the intercutting and showing the different type of styles between Vito and Michael. I think in this film, it shows the origins so well of, characters like Max and like Noodle and the difficulties,
Deborah,
that they've had.
Even
Deborah, absolutely.
And
showing them from a young age to an older age and not really filling in, despite all the time they had to fill in the gaps, they didn't quite fill in all the gaps. And I think, to me, that's one of the brilliant parts of this film.
Even where Treat Williams came from, who played James Conway, and that whole, in the American release, you didn't know. You had no idea. It was you sat there with such a what the fuck look on your face the entire time that you saw the movie. And when you saw it the second time, oh, that's it. Oh, that's where Carol came from. She wasn't just some chick that Max was screaming at to get out when they were planning another heist. It was so needed and it was so well done. No, I'm right there with you, bud.
Absolutely. And again, I think that's something that really, I think, lends itself into the way the plot line is developed. You mentioned that this story takes place during Prohibition. Well, The gang had difficulty, financial difficulty, after the repeal of Prohibition. So what did they do? You see the origins of organized crime then going from Prohibition and moving into the Teamsters Union. And of course, the movie that we just chronicled last month here on Shea Bippy, The Irishman, that was a big part of that. The Teamsters, Jimmy Hoffa, all that, you know, the mob connection with this type of a business. I think this alluded to it. It never showed it overtly. I mean, yeah, I guess you could say it did. There were a lot of scenes that did, you know, overtly show that, and the relationship, and of course the Bailey Corporation and everything that comes down from there. But I think in a lot of ways, it built toward that, and it told the story without ever really having to put it in your face. And that, to me, is what Leone did so well in this film. And if you don't see the original cut, the 3-hour and 49-minute cut, which I did see, I said that this was only the second time I had sat through the entire movie. I did see the original cut, because they do show that on TV every now and then. I don't know if they do it anymore, but they used to show that a lot. And this was never one of my favorite movies. It really wasn't. No. It was always one that I kind of always shunned to the side. And as much as I have such a like for Robert De Niro as an actor, he's one of my favorites of all time, and this had such a great cast, it was never a movie that I could get into. But the 3-hour and 49-minute version, with the cuts and with the ability to advance the plot, makes you appreciate this movie so much more. And that was one of the things that I thought he did so well, was use historical elements in the movie to advance his storyline. And to me, that's the mark of a great film. The few that we've done in the past that do have a basis in historical settings, to me, I think that means the world to it. And we saw Scorsese do it in The Irishman. We've seen Coppola do it in The Godfather. We've seen, you know, the historical elements in Goodfellas and Casino and movies like that. But to me, I think that really was a key part in why this movie is so beloved now, much more than it was when it came out.
Right. And now that everybody has giant 4G frickin' televisions in their living room, for the most part, you can really appreciate what Leone did cinematographically with this movie. It is one of the most beautifully shot movies that I have ever seen in my life. Whether it was whether you're looking at a street scene at the turn of the century, or a shot of the Brooklyn Bridge, it is just fantastic from beginning to end. You just sit there in awe and look at this film and how it was shot and say, this is the way movies should be made.
Absolutely. This is one of those few movies that I've seen, and considering its length, this is quite an accomplishment, folks, where still shots of this movie can be taken at any time and it's a masterpiece. It may not always be easy to look at. Murph has alluded to it. If you're squeamish, or you're a little bit, don't have a real you know, stomach to be able to handle any type of like violent scenes, there's rape depicted in this movie. I mean, there's a lot going on, folks.
This is the most misogynistic film that I have ever seen in the mob genre. It really is. Women were just sex objects. They had nothing to add to this movie, with the exception of Deborah, and that was only because, you know, Max and David both loved her, and she brought something to it. But, you know, Tuesday Wells brought nothing to this. It was vile. Eve, who played Noodle's girlfriend, who after one scene where Noodles, he tries to do something for Deborah. He takes her out to dinner, and she wanted to go to a place on the shore, and he completely rented out the entire restaurant and set it up for, you know, every table in the entire place was set up for two people. A completely romantic scene, a nice romantic scene, walk on the beach, and it ended in a rape. Because that's who these men are. They were all men who just their entire lives took what they wanted without any consequence whatsoever.
Right.
So
absolutely.
You know, it's a difficult movie. Just circling back to what Mike was talking, it is a very difficult movie to see. And I am somebody who has never been really comfortable seeing those types. And that was one of the reasons it was a little difficult for me, you know, being a father of a daughter, to watch these things. Tuesday Weld was who plays Carol, was raped in her initial scene. And it was a very rapey movie.
It was. It absolutely was. And I mean, to add insult to injury in a situation like that, Murph alluded to it about Deborah's rape, but that came on the heels of a marriage proposal.
I
mean,
yeah.
You know, you think about it. I mean, you know, Noodles proposed marriage to her, she declined it, and that was it. It was like, well, okay, well, that, you know, I'm just going to take
what I want anyway. I'm going to get what I want anyway. You know,
absolutely.
Look at what I just did for you. You know,
definitely.
Now it's time for you to give me what I want. And he'd waited, you know, 30 years for it, and he wasn't going to wait anymore, so he took it.
Right,
And that's it. I mean, it just, at the end, you know, these guys are who they are, and they are a bunch of vile, disgusting individuals. And you know, it even goes to the fact that, you know, James Woods, at the climax, I'm really, Mike is sitting there with his perfect notes written out, guys, and he's just motherfucking me because I wanted to do that in 10 minutes and I wanted to do that then. And here's Murph going off on a rant. But
no, I think actually, you know what? We are going off the rails a little bit here, folks. And I think that a movie like this that's so long, that has so many plot intricacies, to outline the plot and advance the plot like we usually do here on Shea Bippy was really not the way I wanted to attack this movie at all. The organic kind of discussion that we're having, I think, lends itself into this movie much, much better. So by all means, when things come up, let it fly, because I think that's the best way to tackle it, and I think our listeners will appreciate
otherwise
it. Otherwise,
we could be here for 3 hours, and we don't want to do that to
and
you
we
people.
Have done that before.
We have done that before. But no, even in the climactic scene, most of you have seen this movie before, but it turns out that, you know, Robert De Niro lives most of his adult life alone and with regret, because he thought that he set up his friends and to try to save their lives, and that didn't happen. And it turned out that it was Max that was the mastermind behind the entire setup, because he was trying to get rid of everybody else so he could have all the money, so he could have Deborah, so he could turn into Mr. Bailey.
Absolutely. And yeah, and there's the vaulting ambition that we like to talk about here,
right?
Which is a phrase that I should really trademark, my friend. I think that's pretty good. I like to think about that. And, you know, vaulting ambition is really, I think that's such a key point in all movies in this genre, is these guys aspire to be something that they're, you know, that they're never going to achieve. And in a way, this movie, I think, does the best justice in terms of the realism. Like you've said, this is that they wanted to remain in the streets. They wanted to remain, you know, part of this underworld. But
with the exception of Max, I'm sorry.
Exactly.
Yeah, I stepped on myself. Yeah.
No. I think that's a good point, because ultimately Max didn't care how he got there. He was content to live in the trenches his entire life, but it didn't mean he didn't
and
want the fame and fortune. And
you
the
know, hence
glamour.
The reason.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah, and hence the reason he was being brought down and investigated at the time, and you know, it's so go ahead.
No, absolutely. I think that's you hit the nail right on the head. It doesn't mean they didn't want the fame and fortune. It doesn't mean they didn't want the glitz and glamour. They wanted all the spoils this life had to give. They realized that this was the best way for them to be able to get it. But, you know, Woods wanted the, you know, he wanted, to quote Joey Zaza from Godfather Part 3, he wanted the little pin from the Pope. Not literally, folks.
There you go.
But
I want a little pin from the Pope. That's it.
Exactly. He wanted that he wanted that type of validation. So, you know,
he
wanted to walk into
the White House and, you know, just a little different thing, you know.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah, this movie just hits on so much, and it is such a long film. And as we're saying here, you know, you still, what makes it a great movie is the fact that it was so long and you still wanted more. So, I mean, if you're sitting there complaining about the run length of The Irishman, this movie probably isn't for you. But if you had no problem with it whatsoever, make a huge bowl of popcorn, hope for a snowstorm, sit down and watch this flick, because it is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. It really, it truly, truly is. One of the things that struck me, there's a lot that struck me about this movie, but one of the things I really wanted to discuss with you today, buddy, was the alliteration of the opening scene being the closing scene as well. And maybe we're going a little, off, but I think it's a good point, and I think it lends itself in well to the discussion to be able to bring this up now. Last year, we chronicled Donnie Brasco. And Donnie Brasco opens with similar shots, similar types of scenes where the camera is focused on Johnny Depp's eyes, and it ends up concluding with almost that same shot. This is not quite that type of alliteration, but the movie opens with, obviously we really didn't get into the nuts and bolts of the plot, but it enters with the Chinese theater. They're looking for these guys are looking for someone, and it ends with the murdering of Eve and that the money has been stolen. So in a lot of ways, the movie closes with that same scene. It opens in 1933 with Noodles entering the opium den after his friend's death, taking the drug, and then grinning ear to ear. I think in a lot of ways, I think Leone's purpose here is to show that the more things change, the more things stay the same. No matter what these guys ever went through, nothing ever changed in their core.
Yep.
And we've talked about that right from the get-go on this, and that's been a prevailing theme. I thought it was brilliant the way Leone did this. And I thought that really tied it all together. I thought that really made that the point in this movie and why this movie has the longevity that it really has.
Yeah, it opened at the close.
Yeah.
It opened at the close. And it was, after all of this, after everything, he's still there hiding out in, with an opium pipe in his mouth. Trying to somehow get away from this life, and that was really the only way that he could.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to take a break in terms of your reality, and you use drugs to be, obviously he's using drugs to be able to do it, but it was inevitably, I think, and this is really the question that I wanted to ask, is what I saw, really just more get your thoughts on this, because what I saw was, yeah, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But the fact that he couldn't get out of it. Do you really believe that Noodles ever wanted to exit? Because that final scene to me twinged something inside of me when I watched it to say that maybe there was a part of him that wanted to be something maybe different than what he was. I think at the end of the day, it wasn't. I think he was just looking for a temporary escape. And I think that's why you saw him grin when he took, the hit from the opium pipe. Could there possibly be an interpretation there where he may have wanted something different and the drug was simply his way of getting that difference? Or do you think he was just simply content to live out, exactly as he is?
No, I think he might have wanted something different from a young age, from when Deborah, was dancing and she got changed. And another uncomfortable moment for a dad seeing Jennifer Connelly at the ripe old age of 13 drop her dress. It was and she's like, well, why did you show me your tush? And she's like, to a roach, to a dirty little roach that climbs up the walls to peek. That means nothing. I think that stuck with Noodles forever. And yeah, I do think he wanted something different, but circumstance just did not let that happen. And his love for his friends, the only people that had been there for him his entire life, it did not let that happen. Max was there when he went to prison for these people, and Max was there when he got out, and all of his money was there when he got out. Everything was down in the company books. And he just knew then that was never going to happen. And that's when I think he went into escapism and it was a perfect way to open and close this movie.
Yeah, agreed. And I'm so glad that you brought that perspective, because it does, it kind of validates a lot of the feelings that I've had, things that we've talked about here in terms of what the director's intentions were, what the audience is thinking when they're viewing that, and being able to bring it and tie it all together. Again, like I said, I thought that was so brilliant in what Leone did here.
Yeah, I agree.
And again, one of the reasons why I think this movie has such a resonance and a rebirth when you watch the full cut. I think you've alluded to this a little bit, my friend, but I'm going to put you on the spot here. Save for, I think, the misogynism that we've spoken about earlier, and the length, maybe. We saw The Irishman gain a lot of notoriety, and we saw it gain a lot of critical acclaim in being a very mm-hmm. long movie. And not for anything, and I hope I'm not alienating any of our listeners here, but one of the knocks on this society is that no one has the attention span to sit through a longer than 3 hour movie any longer.
Right.
And I don't say that, I really don't say that as anything negative, but we're bombarded by so much instant information. And sometimes it's difficult for me to do it. And I like to think of myself as someone that can sit through anything and enjoy a nice long movie. I find it
yep.
difficult to do at times, because you're always, you're looking at your phone. You want to know what's going on in the world. Things are happening. There's break news is breaking all the time. In your opinion, save for the fact that I don't believe the misogynism and some of the graphic nature of the way these things are depicted would ever be able to fly today, could this movie be made today and succeed today if it was marketed in the right way?
I believe so. I really do. I believe that there is a niche audience out there that is larger than the word that would accept this movie, that would go to see it in a movie theater. I think, you know, while we're talking about, you know, people not having the attention span for it, there are also some really epically long movies that have been made in the past decade. The Lord of the Rings movies comes
right.
to mind, some of the Harry Potter films, even some of the Marvel movies have been really long. It would be a movie that I would like to have an intermission in.
Yeah.
There was we can go back to those days. I watched Lawrence of Arabia recently because I just got this new TV and I've been, you know, checking out the epic scenes from some movies that I saw. And you know, in the middle of watching that movie, they actually had intermission. And it is actually on there in the cut that you can watch on TV, you know, in a 15-minute intermission. Maybe something like that would be, you know, you could bring that back and boost some popcorn sales or something. But I do think that the movie could be made today. I'm not sure who would play the parts, but I think it could.
Yeah, in terms of, and not even so much like a like-for-like remake and I probably phrased the question poorly, but you answered it exactly the way I wanted you to answer it. So it's not a knock on your answer in the least. Yeah. My asking of the question was not so much like if, you know, so who would play the roles or anything like that, but the type of movie, the story, just being able to resonate with modern audiences. I fully believe it can. We've seen this genre succeed so many times in different generations. It's not, I don't believe this is a
right.
story that's stuck in
its
time
cyclical.
Period. Exactly. It is cyclical. And I mean, you know, different parts of it could be updated, but I think this story could be told pretty much like for like. I did earlier say, save for some of the misogynism and save for some of the violent nature of the way these things are depicted. I'm going to throw a wrench into this now. Putting those back in, could this movie be made today?
I'm not sure. You know, I'm really not sure. I really think the lunatic fringe out there would have a lot of difficulty with it. But then again, I think the lunatic fringe would have a lot of difficulty with most Mel Brooks movies being made today.
Yeah, I think so. I think in a lot of ways, you look at some of the films that have been made that were made in the 70s, early 80s, times where, you know, maybe the collective consciousness didn't necessarily reflect society's views. I think there was more of a satirical type, wand that they were able to utilize in those days with movies that are made. I happen mm-hmm. to agree with you on that front. I think this movie, in terms of the story and in terms of the plot and in terms of the depth, could absolutely be made and succeed wildly today. But I think there would be a lot of elements.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I think there would be a lot of elements. If it was made a remake like for like, exactly as you see it, if the movie had never been made before and just came out now in 2020, I think there would be a lot of reticence by a lot of different people to see it.
And
I can understand that.
And these movies aren't made anymore. What I mean is a movie that spans this time frame doesn't happen anymore on great regularity. I think that's what a lot of the problems people had with the Irishman were.
Right.
Nowadays it's not a lifetime that is is gone over in a film. A lot of movies in this genre now are more about a story, a heist, or a particular moment in time during what's happening. It's not a lifetime of events that make up a film. It is one particular story. If they tried to do this now, some idiot would say, well, let's do it all about we would see more of the backstory, because it would all be about the diamond heist that they pulled off and when they killed Joe. That's the story that would be told now. I do think that there's an audience. I don't think it's such a small audience that only guys like you and I would go to it. And of course our listeners.
Yes, absolutely. I think you may hit the nail right on the head. I think that there is definitely an audience for this type of a story that has a lot of stories interwoven inside it, but yet not every detail has to be given. Not every aspect of it has to be told. You don't have to necessarily focus on one of these events in order to tell a good story. You can You can hit the high parts of these, but ultimately the story at the helm of this is the growth of young hoodlums that essentially make the decision to delve into this life, and then mm-hmm. their desire to utilize that life to give themselves a lifestyle that they want. It's a little bit less about the aspiration to be legitimate, like we've seen several times in a lot of these films, and we've talked about this several times today already. But I think in this part, it's something that I think a lot of generations, any generation, can relate to, is what you do in life can define you. In a lot of ways, you may want it to define you into something greater than what you are, or you may want it to define you so that way you can enrich who you are. And I think this movie walks that fine line so carefully, and I think that's one of the reasons why it can resonate with today's audience, and it did back in the day. We're coming up probably on about 10 minutes left here on during our time at the Shea Bippy before they turn the lights out on us and Sonny comes in and says, now you can leave. But Murph, closing thoughts on this film. What was your lasting impressions from the movie? Parts that maybe, characters or scenes that maybe we haven't discussed yet today. What stuck with you in this watching, preparing for today in terms of what your memories are going to be of Once Upon a Time in America?
Quite honestly, was the brutality of this movie will stick with me probably forever. It is the most brutal film that I've ever seen in this genre, and that's saying a lot. That's coming from a guy who sits there and sits on the edge of his seat every time Sonny hits the causeway. It's brutally honest. It shows a facet of America growing up that we don't really see in a lot of films, because it goes from literally the right at the turn of the century into the 1970s. It tells that entire time span through the eyes of really one person and what happened around him, It was, and of course, you know, we talked about it before, the fantastic cinematography that went into this movie, the way it was shot, it was just completely beautiful. Through all the ugliness, it was a beautifully done movie.
It truly was. It really, and again, coming back to that point and something that I had said earlier, you can take a still shot at any moment in this movie and it's a masterpiece. It might not be easy to look at. It might not be easy to view. It might be a very difficult, disgusting image, but there's art in it. And that is something that is not easy to do. The cinematography in this was great. In a lot of ways, my takeaways are pretty much the same as yours. My biggest takeaway from this film is that ambition is not universal. It's based on your individual view of what you think your life should be, how you believe that you're going to enrich your own life. And that's something you saw in each one of these characters. And it was different for all of them, but it was also the same for all of them. It was utilizing your lot in life to get what you want out of life. And that's essentially it. There was no apologies made by these characters. There was no remorse from these characters. They were going to do whatever it was they needed to do to make sure that they achieved in life what they wanted. And that's very odd in this type of a genre. The brutality shocked me without any question. I had forgotten how brutal this movie was until you actually watch it. It surprises me that how early this was made and how brutal it was in terms of the types of movies that you see. But again, I think it told the story accurately. I think it had to be the way it was. And I think if it wasn't, I don't think the story would have been the same. It had to depict a certain quality in all of these characters. And I think the brutality added to it. And while it may be difficult to watch, and again, folks, if you haven't seen it and you are of the faint of heart, this may not be one that you want to check out. And it's not something that Murph and I say a lot here on Shea Biffy. We usually highly recommend you watching films. And I do highly recommend you watching this one. This is a great one. But if you are of the faint of heart, this can cause, especially if you have any type of squeamishness, and totally understandable when it comes to some of the violence that you've seen and some of the assaulting type, sexual assaulting type violence that's depicted in this film. If that in any way triggers either a memory or a feeling inside you, this could do that. So be careful in watching.
Even if you ever looked at one of your kids and said, "Did he get switched at the in the hospital? Is that my kid?" That'll even do it.
Exactly. It's true. It really, really is. And, you know, ultimately, I think that's the lasting memory of this, is that ambition can be different in everyone. And that's my takeaway from this film.
Great take.
I'm going to leave you with a tidbit, my friend. I always do. I always end on a tidbit. Believe it or not, and I don't think it's much of a secret, but there was a lot of rumors going around at the time that a lot of the characters, primarily the Noodles character, but a lot of different characters, were loosely based on the adventures of Meyer Lansky. And because of that, Robert De Niro is a method actor, studied at the Actors Studio under Lee Strasberg. He believes in immersing himself into a character. And he tried to reach out to Lansky, who was in prison at the time, and he tried to ask him whether he wanted to sit down with him and discuss the character and discuss the role. Lansky flat out refused to meet with him and said that, you know, he wouldn't give a reason, but that he would absolutely, under no circumstances, sit down with him to discuss anything related to a film like that. And if you're looking for any type of validation about the realism in this film, I think that says all you need to know about it. The fact that Lansky would not sit down with him, would not lend him any information or any type of insight, to me speaks volumes. And, you know, De Niro said to this day, he says, I don't take it personally. He says, but, you know, he says that might have helped my portrayal a little bit more. But in a way, he also said maybe it was the best thing that ever happened, because he didn't have Lansky's point of view in mind when he did this. He really made it all about the Noodles characters. So it's funny how things can be a blessing and a curse at the same time. Could that have helped the plot line a little bit in terms of realism? Maybe, but I agree with De Niro. I think that might have taken away a little bit and made it more about Lansky than really what this novel, what this movie was scheduled to be, or supposed to be, I should say. So yeah, that's my last little tidbit on the film. And I hope if you haven't known that,
I did
gives
not.
You a little bit more insight.
And I actually have one for you, and I was glad that you didn't bring it up because I have one for you. Now, we all know that in The Godfather Part 3, we talked earlier about how people claim that Leone stole from Coppola. And so in The Godfather Part 3, Francis Ford Coppola, I thought very well. I know that I'm almost alone in this. He cast his daughter Sophia in it. In this movie, Sergio Leone actually cast his daughter in the movie, and his daughter Francesca played a small part in this movie as a girlfriend. And so there was my tidbit for it. She played David Bailey's girlfriend and was uncredited in the movie. But, you know, go ahead and check that. There you go. There's my tidbit for Mike this week.
You stumped me because that is one I did not know. And I usually do pretty good research. It's hard
to
stump me when it comes to these tidbits. But that was a great one. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that because it really shows that a lot of, directors did something very similar. Albeit, I know the Sofia Coppola role was a much larger role. That wasn't intended for her. I think a lot of people need to remember that. That role was actually supposed to be Winona Ryder, but when we chronicle that movie, we'll get into that a little bit more. But that's a great tidbit about his daughter, Francesca.
Well,
and I'm going to have to go back and check that out before this disappears from the I almost said the locked on realm. You can hear where my head is right now, folks.
Mm-hmm.
But in the on demand realm for TCM,
I
might have to go back and check that out a little bit. See, Murph leaves us on a note where it leaves you wanting more, and it leaves you wanting to go back and check things out. So,
well, I'm glad. I'm glad I got to poke you right in the rib there where you know you'll have to go back and see it again. But no, even with the problems that I had with this movie, on a personal note, it is still a fantastic film that I would recommend for anybody who has a lot of time on their hands, a good air popcorn maker, and maybe somebody that enjoys these kind of movies and you can sit down with on the couch on a snowy day and just check it out, because believe me, it's a lot better than a lot of the stuff that your wife is going to pull up on demand and make you watch for the next 12 hours.
And on that note, my friends, no, just kidding. I definitely recommend watching the film. Hopefully, our discussion today has maybe whet your appetite a little bit to go back and to watch it. I know this was a little bit of a different approach than we usually take with movies like this, but given the length and given the intercuts and a lot of the difficulties that we've had, this could have ended up being about a 4-hour podcast, and we probably still wouldn't have even scratched the surface. I think we hit the highlights for you, and please, by all means, feel free to reach out to myself at MDABATEFPC. Reach out to Murph at TMurph207. We love to hear your feedback. We love to hear what we're doing well, what we could possibly do better here on Shape Hippie. This is a labor of love for the both of us. We both love these types of movies. We've said it several times. To me, there's nothing greater than being able to share the microphone with Murph and discuss these films. We always have a blast. We hope that you do as well. Murph, I can't thank you enough, buddy. Thank you for joining me today here at the bar. And
neither can I.
Reopening the Bippy in 2020. It's great stuff. And we'll definitely be back on more of a regular schedule now, folks. The holidays can really kind of poke holes in a lot of what's going on.
Yeah.
There's, been some personal stuff going on with me, all is well now, but there's, been some scheduling snafus that we've had to deal with as well. So I thank this man for his patience. Absolutely. I thank him for sticking with me.
I will sit at the end of the bar and sip this good scotch until you walk through the door, my friend. And, we will be back. And if you have anything that we haven't covered in the past that you would like to see us take a dive into, please, by all means, we are open to suggestion.
Absolutely. And something that we've alluded to several times here on the Shea Bippy Mob Pod is opening up the Bippy mailbag. And you know what? I think it may be time to do that. So, you know what? We'll start opening up the Shea Bippy mailbag and let us know your questions, your concerns, some of your favorite in mob movies, some of your favorite mob movies, and we will be happy to chronicle those questions. If you have questions, we'd love to hear them, and do your best to stump Murph and myself. So not an easy task, but it can be done, folks. So if you think you've got what it
usually
takes,
more me than Mike,
know.
But yeah, go ahead. A lot easier. You want to stump somebody,
well,
stump me, not
me
Mike.
Today. Well, you stumped me mm-hmm. today, my friend. So you know what? You're right in there with me, and we will be sure to tackle those. But for my great friend Thomas Murphy, I am Mike DeBate. We thank you for joining us today on this episode of Shea Bippy Mob Bar, the podcast you can't refuse. Sonny has turned the lights on, the door is open, and he's just told us that now we can leave. So enjoy the day. Thank you for tuning in, and we look forward to joining you the next time.